If you are visiting us today, we particularly welcome you. Please sign the guest ledger on the visitor's table in the foyer. There are a variety of information listed there on the table about our church and Unitarian Universalism. Help yourself to anything that interests you. I will be in the social hall after the service if you have any questions about our church or if you have been visiting for a while and would just like information about becoming a member. I'd be happy to talk to you about that. If you are visiting us with your children today, it is our custom for the children to remain with us until after the offertory, at which time they will go to the religious education classes. Your child is welcome to join them or remain in the service. If you'd like to go along to observe your child's class, please do so. The nursery is just out the doors to my right and across the entryway if there's a need for childcare at all during the service. We always enjoy getting to know our guests. If any members have brought guests today, we would be pleased if you would introduce them. If any guests have just brought themselves and feel comfortable about introducing themselves, this would be a great time to do so. We'd like to warmly welcome you. Everyone is invited to gather in the social hall after our service for refreshments and conversation. The conversation in corner is a good place to continue and gather for a further discussion about the service. Please put your cell phones on silence mode for our service. And I hope you find this morning's service fulfilling. Our speaker today is Isa Sadlan. Muhammad Isa Sadlan was born in Milwaukee. He attended Christ King Catholic Church in Wauwatosa, then Marquette High School, and then earned a degree in comparative literature at UW-Madison. He was introduced to Islam 25 years ago and entered Islam 21 years ago. Isa often serves as imam, the prayer leader, and khatib, the one who gives the sermon at mosques in Milwaukee and other cities. He is executive director and CEO of the Islamic Society of Milwaukee and represents his faith on the Interfaith Conference of Greater Milwaukee Cabinet. Welcome, Isa.
Please turn to your hymnal, number 444, for a responsive reading. This house is for the ingathering of nature and human nature. It is a house of freedom, guarding the dignity and worth of every person. It is a house of truth-seeking, where scientists can encourage devotion to their quest, where mystics can abide in a community of searchers. It is a house of prophecy, outrunning times past and times present in visions of growth and progress. Let us join in our chalice lighting. The words are in your order of service. The children would like to come forward for our story of For All Ages, which will be read by Kara Duma with her hoarse voice.
All right, come on up. Come on up close, because there's small pictures in this book. So come on up, and Mona will show you the pictures, and I'll read you the story. So our speaker today is about is being given by a man from the who practices the religion of Islam, and this story is about a boy who also practices that religion. And it's about a boy named Ahmet. He says, "My name is Ahmet. I live in Detroit. I am Muslim. That means that I practice the religion of Islam. Muslims live in many different countries. The word Islam means submission to God. Being a Muslim means following a way of life every day in order to please God. We pray 5 times a day. When we pray, we take off our shoes and kneel toward Mecca, a holy city in Saudi Arabia." And our middle schoolers know something about this because they went and learned about this and went to the Islamic Society. The word for God in Arabic, the language of our religion, is Allah. My mother and father have taught me that nothing can be compared to Allah. Allah is different from all people and all things. Nothing is like Allah. We believe that Allah knows all things and can do all things and has always existed. Everything exists because Allah wills or wants it to exist. We believe that a man named Muhammad was one of Allah's prophets. The book about how Allah wants us to live our lives was revealed to Muhammad. This book is called the Quran. We believe that Muhammad received the Quran from Allah's angel. We believe that the Quran came from Allah. My family reads the Quran often. We study it so that we can understand how Allah expects us to behave. My father says that the Quran was written in heaven before Allah created all things. My family goes to a mosque to pray and to learn about our faith. Muslim religious leaders, called imams, teach us. Every mosque has a tower called a minaret, and 5 times a day, a muezzin, a person who goes up in the tower, calls us to prayer. In order to understand how to practice our religion, we have Sharia, or Islamic law. Sometimes my father or his friends ask our imams to explain the law and how we should understand it. There are 5 main duties or pillars in Islam. The first pillar of a Muslim is to recite the Shahada, which is our confession of faith. A second pillar is to pray correctly. We believe that an angel showed Muhammad how to pray. All Muslims pray in the same way. First, we remove our shoes, we wash our hands and face and feet, we kneel down on a clean spot on the ground or on a mat. When we pray, we face toward Mecca. We pray 5 times a day, at dawn, in the middle of the day, in the afternoon, after sunset, and before going to bed. A third pillar is the Hajj, a journey to the holy city of Mecca. Every Muslim must try to make the Hajj at least once in his or her life. During the Hajj, people say prayers and listen to sermons. There are special activities that everyone does together. And I look forward to the day that I can make the Hajj with my family. The fourth pillar is the observance of Ramadan. Ramadan is a month where we fast from dawn to sunset. This means that adults and older kids do not eat all day. I don't have to fast like my parents and sisters because I'm still young. During Ramadan, we remember our duty to God. At the end of the month, we have a great feast called Eid al-Fitr, the festival of breaking the fast. And the fifth pillar is giving alms or charity to the poor. The giving of charity is a very important part of being a good Muslim. It's called zakat. The Quran teaches us to give to the poor, to the needy, and to travelers. So that's a little bit about what it means to be a Muslim. Thanks for listening. And thanks for your honor.
Please rise as you're willing and able for our opening hymn number 134. The offertory is a sacrament of the free church, which is supported by the voluntary generosity of all who join with us. The offering will now be given and received in grateful appreciation of our shared hopes and values. Thank you. Please join in our responsive reading, number 609 from the Islamic tradition. To worship God is nothing other than to serve the people. All peoples are members of the same body, created from one essence. The others cannot stay at rest. Now is the time for our service, where you may are welcome to share joys and concerns. As is our custom, I will light the first candle. The first candle is a candle of hope, that we may all share in the respect and understanding of one another. If you have a joy or a concern which you'd like to share, please raise your hand. An usher will bring a microphone. And please give us your first name, and I'll light a and your concern or joy, and I'll light a candle for you.
Hi, I'm Barb. I'd like a candle of concern for a friend of mine who was diagnosed with stage 4 lymphoma this week. So your prayers and good thoughts are appreciated.
Hi, I'm John. Could you please light a candle of concern regarding that oil drilling platform that tipped over, and at first there was no oil, and now they think as much as 1,000 barrels a day might be leaking into the Gulf of Mexico, and let's hope that's not the case and that it's capped and we'll not have a huge environmental disaster.
Hi, I'm Janica. Please light a candle of joy or thanks for all the people who put on the Brew Fest last night. It was so much fun, and our church did such a great job, especially at the commercials and the beer. It was a lot of fun.
I'm Kristen. If you could light a candle of concern for a friend, Tina, who was recently diagnosed with breast cancer.
I'm Sue. You light a candle of concern for my cousin Larry. His daughter died of an overdose of drugs this week. And a candle of concern for our friend Kimberly Redding and her kids. Her husband Wynn lost his battle with cancer this week.
I'm Diane. Please light a candle of concern for my sister-in-law, Nancy. She was just diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's, and now they have found that she has non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. She'll be having tests this coming week to find out what stage she's in and if there's any treatment possible.
Good morning, this is Jenny. Please light a candle of concern regarding the recent legislation in the state of Arizona that targets immigrants and forces anyone who looks different or speaks differently to carry papers with them. And I hope the rest of the country does not go in that same direction.
I'm Amy. Please light a candle of concern for my dad, who's facing some new health challenges the past few weeks. Thank you.
Good morning. My name's Will, and a candle of joy to be back with my family after an extended time on the road.
a final candle for the joys and concerns we keep in our hearts.
This morning's meditation is coming from something written 1,100 years ago by a poet named Saadi. And Saadi tells us that there are two kinds of people who experience unnecessary pain and hardship. One is the kind of person who collects possessions, wealth, and does not make good use of them. And the other is one who gains experience but does not use it to benefit anyone. However much knowledge you acquire, if you did not use it, you may as well be ignorant. You are neither a person who is seeking truth, but you are just like a donkey carrying a load of books. A brainless beast knows neither nor cares whether its burden is hardwood or books. Let all of us take the knowledge that has come to us and is available to us through all sources. May we use it to benefit not only ourselves but all humanity. Let us have a moment of prayer. In Greater Milwaukee, so this is the fourth I've attended. Whenever I come into your presence, I feel very happy because it's such a friendly environment and all of you are such interesting people who really care about others, care about learning, care about a whole range of things. Just listening to your concerns this morning, you know, these are the concerns of all of us, whether it's issues of mortality, our environment, our beloved family. And how do we address these issues? How do we live with the high points and the low points? A Muslim, an Islamic understanding, is really nothing unusual, nothing peculiar. We heard Carrie talk a little bit about the beliefs of a Muslim, the lifestyle of a Muslim. We fall within this great broad tradition of monotheism, Judeo-Christian understanding. And one aspect of our understanding is that a very important part of our religion is, in fact, both giving advice and listening to advice, taking advice. And in Arabic, there's a word called nasiha. Nasiha means giving advice. And it's a requirement of our religion. You must give honest advice. Now, a wonderful thing about nasiha or advice is that the person who receives it does not have to take it. There's no requirement to take it because, you know, if we took all the advice we received in our lives, we'd be running in nice little circles all the time. So we have to use our own wisdom to decide which advice is useful and which is not. The advice that I want to share with you today is the advice that was given by a man who was about ready to die. And this man is known in historical books as Ali ibn Abu Talib. He lived between 600 and 661 of the Common Era. And he was the cousin of the Prophet Muhammad. He grew up in his household. He was the first man to accept Islam as his religion outside of the Prophet. His family was very close to that of the Prophet. When Ali grew up to be a young man, he married the Prophet's oldest daughter, and by this daughter had two sons, Hassan and Hussein. Later in his life, he became the fourth leader of the Muslim people, the fourth Khalifa. And historically, you all know of Ali because you have all heard of Shiites. And Shiites are the followers of Ali, Shiism. Ali is part of that. So Ali plays a very important historical and religious role, and he's known as a very thoughtful individual. And there are volumes of things that he wrote and letters and reflections. And I want to share with you the reflection that is represented by a letter he wrote to his beloved son Hassan about 3 or 4 days prior to his death. And the times in which Ali lived were tumultuous. So many of the leaders ended up getting assassinated. It was very easy to assassinate people through poison or stabbing in the back or what have you. And Ali ended up being assassinated. And the advice he gave his son really encapsulates what the important dimensions, what the important aspects of Islam are. But it's a universal advice. It's the kind of advice that you and I can take something home today that's as valuable as it is today in 2010 as it was in the year 661. Ali both wrote and spoke in a very literary manner. And he tells his son, Hassan, he says, "This is from the father who is shortly to die, who acknowledges the hardships of these times, and who is already turned away from life. And he submitted himself," referring to himself, "to the problems, the calamities of time. He is one who realizes the evils of the world. He is one who is already living in the abode or the house of the dead and is due to depart on any day." And he's addressing this to my son, the son who yearns for what is not to be achieved. And of course, this is all of us. You know, we all have these fabulous dreams, and we only achieve a tiny part. And who is already treading the path of those who have already died. And of course, we know the common end for all of us is this end of mortality. So we're all treading the same path of people who have already died, who is the victim of ailments, who is entangled in the worries of the days, who is a target of the hardships, a slave of the world, a traitor of its deception, a debtor of its wishes, a prisoner of mortality, an ally of worries, a neighbor of griefs, a victim of distresses, who has been overpowered by desires, and who is a successor of the dead. My own father wrote me almost every day when I lived in the Philippine Islands. Never wrote me like this, much more prosaic, but in the same sense, you know, sharing the status of our existence and the things that matter to us. And Ali tells his own son, and Ali, as we understand, 60 years old, 61 years old, about to die, he says, "The most important thing, the number one thing, is to be conscious, to be aware of God. Be aware that you're not alone. Be aware that, you know, you came from something, that there's a purpose to your life." So he says, "I advise you to be conscious of God, O my child, to abide by the commands of God, to fill your own heart with the remembrance of God, and to cling to that hope which God has given to all of us. No connection, nothing in this whole universe is more reliable, more predictable than the connection between you and God. So take hold of it. Enliven your own heart by talking about it, talking about those things which matter, those things which have relevance. Energize your own life by a firm belief in what is right, by those things which God has let us know about. Make sure that we humiliate ourselves or be humble to ourselves by understanding and being aware and conscious of our own mortality, by recalling death. Make sure that we always fear the authority of our time, those people in charge, those people who have power or want power. Be wary of them. You know, don't take hook, line, and sinker everything that people of power and authority give us, because there's always agendas that we can't understand. Recall that whatever is going to happen to you has happened to many generations before you. So this is, you know, very broad, conceptual, moral-based advice. Then he goes on, the next piece of advice he gives, he says, give up discussing what you do not know and speaking about what does not concern you. You know, we go from the most lofty to the most pragmatic. And, of course, how much of our own time is spent thinking and talking about things that are really not our business, or about things that really don't concern us? The whole dimension of reality TV and reality talk shows and all these things are really a dimension of things that have no value or impact on our life, but yet take a lot of our time. So Ali is telling us 1,400 years ago, hey, give this stuff up. Don't worry about things which aren't really going to affect your life. And Ali says, habituate yourself. Get used to endure hardships. Now, this is contrary to modern wisdom, isn't it? Where we do absolutely everything to make sure there are no hardships. We have 5 baths in our house, so we don't have to wait 1 second, right? But Ali is saying, no, 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 get used to hardships. Hardships aren't bad things. You know, sometimes we think hardships are evil or somehow a problem, but Ali's saying, get used to these hardships because it builds character. It builds endurance. That life is not easy. That there's going to be a lot of problems in our life, that 5 bathrooms and 4 cars and a wardrobe and 14 different iPhones and equipment are not going to solve. So get used to those basic hardships of life so that we can endure the problems that we are going to face. The problems that people talked about today and shared with us cannot be solved by the things, by the material things of this world. They can only be resolved and dealt with by what is inside of us, by the endurance and the hope and the wisdom that we have in our heart. Appreciate my advice, O my child, and know that the one who is the master of death, referring to God, is also the master of life. That the Creator causes death, the Creator causes illness, but also the Creator causes cure. The Creator gives us hope. The Creator gives us answers. That none of us should ever feel hopeless or sense of misery, because in fact for all of us there is a resolution. There is an answer. There is a sense that something is going to be better. And Ali then goes on and tells his son the golden rule. Oh, my child, make yourself the measure for dealings between yourself and other people. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. For thus you should desire for others what you desire for yourself, and hate for others what you hate for yourself. Do not oppress. Do not be like the oppressed, or do not oppress people. Do good to others as you would like it done to you. Regard bad for yourself whatever you regard as bad for others. Do not talk about what you do not know. Do not say to others what you do not like said to you. Then he goes on to another kind of topic. And it's a psychological topic. And Ali says that know that self-admiration, I'm pretty good. I'm really wonderful. Self-admiration is contrary to propriety, and it's a calamity for our mind. So those people who are too invested in their own ego, in their own self-important, this is not good. This is not only misleading, but it's not healthy. So he tells his son, even though he's going to eventually be the leader of the community, very wealthy, very so-called powerful person, be careful. Don't get too caught up in self-admiration and enthusiasm for your own accomplishments. He tells Hassan, he says, you know that in front of you lies a road of a very long distance. And he's talking about life as we move through our lives. And there's a lot of hardships, and we can't avoid these hardships. As we go along this journey of life, take requirements of provision, keeping the burden light. Now, any of you who are good travelers, you know, the guy with three huge 42-kilo bags and whatever doesn't have an easy trip. And Ali is using this metaphor that when you have this trip through life, don't get too burdened down. Don't take too much along with you. Whenever you come across a needy person who can carry your provision and hand it back to you on the day of judgment when you would need it, then accept this as an opportunity. Now, what does this mean? It means wealth, the things that are in excess of what we need. Don't hoard them. Don't try to carry them through life with us, but give them away. Give them to the poor. Feed the hungry. Take care of our environmental problems. Give to charity. Educate people. Because there's a payback. Whether you believe in a hereafter or not, there's a payback. If you believe in a hereafter, then in fact, all the good you do here on this earth comes back to you in the next. So Ali says, make sure you've got a light burden. Don't accumulate too much. Give it away. Let other people enjoy it. And that there will be a payback, not only in this life and the next. If a person is willing to borrow from you in your days of affluence to pay back to you at the time of need, then take this as a great opportunity. So those of us who have acquired wonderful educations, what's the payback? You use your education to teach others, to serve others, to do something useful, not worrying about the money. The money obviously always comes somehow or someplace. But in fact, use these benefits that we've been given for the sake of other people, and that's the true value of anything that we're giving. Then he goes on to remind us. He says, oh, my child, know that you have been created for the next world, not for this. And, you know, when we all think about our bodies that are decaying and get diseased and issues of mortality, you know, somehow we kind of miss, we try not to think about these things. But in fact, our bodies were not made for this world. Our bodies are made to last a certain period of time. They're pretty good for much of our days, and then they start going down. Sometimes people have terrible problems even as a youngster. But in fact, the end for all of us is not too far out, 20, 30, 40, 100 years. But to understand that we're not made for this world, we're really made for something else. And this is all part of the Islamic concept. The Islamic concept is that all of us were put on this earth, try to do as much good as we can, try to avoid as much harm as we're capable of, that God in his mercy then judges us by whatever good we can do. And if we do enough good deeds in this world, and in fact the life in the next world is very sweet for us. So this is the religious background for the advice that Ali is giving his son. Be prepared against death, because it's going to surprise all of us. And I know in my own family, you know, grandma or grandpa or my parents now, we're always kind of shocked when they finally die. But in fact, we shouldn't be. I mean, this is part of the natural part of life. And Ali then goes on to say that I should prefer that you keep what is in your hands rather than begging or being groveling or being grasping for what other people have. It's better to have the bitterness of disappointment than to go out and try to pander and to kind of sell yourself out for the things that other people have. So he's talking about self-respect. He's talking about satisfaction in the basis of contentment. And the basis of happiness, the basis of all of our pleasure, is not in what we have. It's in how happy we are with what we have, how satisfied we are with what we have. All of us know very wealthy, talented, capable people who are absolutely miserable because they aren't wealthier than what they are or not smarter than what they are. And we know very poor people who are just smiling and happy little campers. Why? They're satisfied with what God has given them. So the secret of self-happiness, contentment, is not in what we have, it's in how we view what we have. The satisfaction of being content with whatever has been written for us, whether it's being tall and good-looking or short or not so good-looking or a long life or a short life, sick or healthy, but to find contentment and happiness in whatever situation we have. And Ali then says that Ali is known for aphorisms. He's short, little tidbits of information, just much like Benjamin Franklin. You know, they would have gotten along very well in terms of their approach to life. And Ali says that the best guard of a person's secret is himself, that the person who speaks much speaks nonsense, that whoever considers something carefully gains wisdom. Associate with people of virtue, and then you yourself will become virtuous. Stay away from people who are scumballs and dishonest and deceitful, because you'll avoid having those kind of behaviors affect you. The worst food, the absolute worst food on earth, is that which you gain through unlawful means. If you cheat somebody, if you are dishonest in order to bring money home, in fact, the food you give your family for based on unlawful or horrible earnings is not a good meal. It's a bad meal. And oppressing the weak is the worst kind of oppression. Then he talks about friendship. And I don't know about your background, but I guess my background is very typical of much of the Midwest. I have a large family. Some are rural, some are city folk. But in our family, there's always groups of people who have stopped speaking to other groups of people. You know, there's aunt so-and-so who, you know, doesn't call anymore. We haven't heard from cousin so-and-so. They just won't talk to anybody anymore. You know, people cut themselves off from our family. Same with friends. What Ali says about this, he says, if you intend to cut yourself off from a friend or a family member, and we all are inclined to do this periodically, always leave the door open to resume that friendship or the relationship at a later day. Don't make the killer comment. Don't do that outrageous deed that cuts it all off for all time. Yeah, we get upset. Yes, we get our feelings hurt. Yes, there's problems. Maybe we don't want to talk to somebody for a while. That's fine. But don't do something that closes the door forever. In Islam, there's a custom that we can have arguments, we can have disagreements, but we have to go back and talk to the person we were angry at within 3 days. We can't stay mad for a week. We can't not take calls for a week. You got to go back in there, 3 days, cool off, get over it, and kind of go back in. And this is also what Ali is saying. You know, just always leave the door open for a rapprochement, of bringing the relationship back together again. And then the final advice he gives is he talks about our impulses of good and evil. And all of us are a collection of good and evil. I mean, we know ourselves. We know that we do some nice things and some bad things, and none of us are 100% perfect or 100% evil, that we're a combination of the two. And we all know that we have our temptations. We all have our hot buttons. For some people, it's their anger. For some people, it's greed. For some people, it's ego. You name it. Ali tells his son Hassan, he says, you know, my son, whenever you feel this impulse to be naughty, to do something you shouldn't be doing, delay it. Delay doing the naughty deed. Delay saying the horrible thing. Delay. You can always do the naughty thing later. Don't worry about it. You know, put it off for 10 minutes. You can do it 10 minutes from now, but the more time you put between this impulse to misbehave and actually doing it, the less chance you have of doing something you don't want to do. This is the final advice to the son. And I say, what a wonderful advice. You know, just cool it, just relax. We can always call up and give somebody a piece of our mind. We can always tell somebody what we really think about them. We can do that, but let's just put it off a bit. My dear friends, there is available to us the complete wisdom of the world in many areas. Whether we want to look at the internet and read and talk to the elders and listen to our children, there's sources of wisdom everywhere. Really, the choice that we have every single day when we get up is, you know, what kind of person do we want to be? How do we want to lead our life? What are our values, and do we take our values and implement them in our way of life? I think it's too easy for all of us to be kind of heedless and mindless and thoughtless and be on autopilot and just develop a force that we just kind of go out and move and move and move without reflecting about what am I doing? Why am I doing something? What is the purpose? Is this a good thing or a bad thing? Is there value or is there no value? What impact does it have on my family, the environment, my neighbors? All of us, I think, are well versed in what we should be doing. It's really that decision on how we want to lead our life. Let us reflect upon that and ask to be enthused and infused with what is right. Let each one of us closely examine the choices that are available to us. Let us always be aware that we're only one tiny piece of this universe, that we need to respect all of the creation of this universe, every single aspect of it, from the air to the mountains, to the animals, to the people. Let us have empathy and sympathy for other people. Let us lead our lives knowing that we're not going to remain on this earth, that we're here for a brief moment, that our job is to do as much good as we can and to avoid as much evil. Thank you. Amen.
Please stand as you're willing and able for our closing hymn, number 168.
More prayer, one more song. We will sing one more song till every song is sung by everyone. We'll say one more song.
Now we have some time for a sharing of your thoughts, or some if you have some questions for Isa, please raise your hand, and a host will bring a microphone around for you, and I'm sure our guests will be happy to answer any questions.
Hi, I'm Angel. I, as a recovering Catholic, I'm very aware of where some men get this idea that they're superior to women and can put women down. Where are these verses or whatever they're called in the Quran that give some of these men the idea that it's okay to do to women what's being done to them in Afghanistan today?
I think there are no verses in the Quran which allow people to do these horrible sexist things. What we have is you have people in cultural environments who, whether they were Muslim or Hindu or Christian, would abuse women based on their own bad thoughts and based on their own culture. So what you have in all of our texts and holy books is verses regarding family behavior, family actions, and then people with their warped culture will take that twist it and justify their bad deeds based on a holy book. But there's nothing in the Quran that understood in the context in which it was revealed and the context in which the Prophet Muhammad gave the teachings to the people that allows anyone to abuse anyone anytime. So we have to always separate what is Islam, what are the teachings of the Prophet, and then you've got the actions of people, Muslims who misbehave, Muslims who are ignorant, Muslims who misuse what has been given to them in the wrong way.
Hi, my name is Will. I remember when Jane first came and joined our congregation, and one of the first things she asked about is diversity, so I want to thank the guiding forces in our church to bring you here and speak with us this morning. And the thing that strikes me the most is that in bringing diversity to the church, the more it seems that it's the same, that we all have the same desires in our lives to care for our families, ourselves, and our world, so that the things that seem to keep us apart because of the unknowing of one another's religion and beliefs are actually the things that are the closest that bring us together.
Yes, thank you for the comment. And I think we're seeing that with these immigration laws and the fear that people have about others coming in and the culture. One of the things that I do today in going around not only the U.S. but in Asia, Africa, Europe, talking to young Muslims who feel oppressed, because to be a Muslim today in many Western societies means you're going to be harassed, the government's going to be after you, you might end up, there's a lot of problems. But you look at our own American culture, what happens here in the United States. And if you read the newspaper 100 years ago, you talk about those violent terrorists who come to our shores, those people who are causing so much disruption in our society. And who are they talking about? The Irish. You talk a little bit further, using the same language, that would be the poor Chinese. And now we look how the Hispanics are kind of vilified in the Southwest, the Muslims in other parts. You know, there's always an other who it's easy to blame society's problems on. So as you say, the key is trying to get to know people, get beyond this otherness, get down to the core human values. Where we are misbehaving, let one another know it. There's no excuse for misbehaving. But in fact, to dislike somebody just because of their color or where they're from is really ignorance.
Hi, my name is Janica, and I appreciated many words of wisdom that you gave to us. One in particular that I'm going to try and implement this is the three-day rule with friends or, you know, family. I have a best friend that I've known for 30 odd years, and she's like a sister to me. And we don't live in the same town, but being as how we're both very opinionated women, we get into many kinds of discussions, and you know, tensions arise and so forth. But one thing that I'm very happy about is the last time, we don't have a lot of disagreements, but the last time we did, you know, we got very hissy with each other, and it even came out in emails, and, you know, but we didn't, we only went back and forth once, and then the upshot was telling each other that we loved each other, and really that was the only thing that mattered. And that interaction with her just gave me so much joy and hope and good feeling. It's like, at the end, nothing really matters except that last statement.
Good. Thank you for sharing that. You know, there's a wonderful story that the Prophet Muhammad told his followers. He said that, you know, arguing and getting in disagreements with people is natural. But, in fact, when you have a disagreement, the purpose of these arguments or debates is not to win. If you want to always win the argument, what are you doing? This is trying to show I'm right, I'm smarter, I'm better. This is not the purpose of arguments. This is, you know, try to clarify, not to show you're better. So in fact, then the Prophet Muhammad then went on to say that the highest place in the paradise is for not the person who gives up an argument, but the person who gives up an argument when they're right. So even though you know you're right, give it up, you know, just stop. Move on to something else, and what you've done is a great example. Thank you.
I'm Terry, and I just have a question. I'm over here.
Yes.
About what the belief in the afterlife is, yes, and how that drives behavior here.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, as a Muslim, like many Christians and many Jews, we understand that this life is temporary. And if you believe that life is temporary and that yet there's a purpose for it, then we kind of explore what is the reason for it, how should we lead our life. And from an Islamic point of view, God, through his mercy, has given us lots of guidance. Every one of the prophets who came here taught us what to do, the golden rule, the Ten Commandments. You know, we all hear this stuff. But that there's a day of accountability, that whatever you've done in this life is going to follow you to the next. These people who seem to get away with everything are in for a horrible surprise. These mass murderers, those people who do these horrible deeds, have to come on a day of judgment and are held accountable. In the Islamic point of view, this accountability works this way. Day of judgment comes. Day of judgment is not a day. It could be 50,000 years. Each one of us goes to that day of judgment with our good deeds and our bad deeds. If you go to that day of judgment, God weighs these good and bad deeds. If, in fact, your good deeds outweigh your bad deeds, God says, okay, you get a pass to keep on moving into the heavens. If your bad deeds outweigh your good deeds, then you might have to spend some time being purified. That's a place of the hellfires and what have you. Now, if you are a terrible individual and you've harmed somebody in this life, let's say someone has hurt you, on the day of judgment, that person has to go to you, ask for forgiveness, and make amends with you personally for any harm that was done. And the only way that the person can make amends on the day of judgment for the harm they've given you is, in fact, to give you some of their good deeds, if they have them, or to take your bad deeds on themselves if they don't have them. So these people who are the mass murderers, of course, have no good deeds left. All the people they've harmed, whatever bad deeds those people had who were harmed by these villains, is absorbed by the bad guys. And the bad people really have a terrible, terrible time. So there is accountability. Everything is answered in the end. Everything good that you have in your life will follow you. We also understand as a Muslim that God is very, very merciful, that it's not just a quid pro quo. You do this, one good deed, I give you one bonus point. No, we know in the Quran it says, you do something good, God gives you 100 bonus points, 1,000 bonus points. You know, God is on our side. God isn't being mean to us. God is merciful to us. So whatever good we do, we're going to see it. Whatever bad we do, we're also going to see it. And that's all part of the afterlife.
My name is Betsy. I have a question. Can you recommend a brief response to if someone makes a comment that indicates they have misconceptions about Islam as, you know, being all the more radical fundamentalist version of Islam?
You know, I think that within all religious traditions, there's a pendulum of points of view from the most liberal to the most conservative. And that's true in Islam, that we do have people who have an extreme point of view. However, in the Quran, in our teachings, God tells us that the only people who are safe are those not on the extremes, but those in the center. So Islam is taught as a centrist religion, that whenever you think that you know more than somebody else, you're doomed. It's a terrible thing. Now, unfortunately, you've got people who think they know more than others and do misdeeds, but it's not the majority of the Muslims. Just like it wasn't the majority of the Christians during the Inquisition who thought all these horrible things. Or you look at the Hindus and Hindu nationalism and all the things that were done because of that. Their extremists exist, but the extremists are not pulling their understanding from the authentic understanding of Islam. Just like the extremists in Christianity
who did horrible things are not taking the word of Jesus. They're making up things. So I think we have to tell people who say, well, Muslims are a problem, they're terrorists, or this, they're that. See, go and talk to, go to a mosque, go and visit people, go and understand where the great vast majority of Muslims are. Try to separate the difference between Islam and people who use Islam to misbehave, because there is a difference.
I just wondered what you're feeling about agnostics are, and if they're perfectly good people and do all the right things, that, do you still have respect for them?
As a Muslim, we are required to have respect for every human being, regardless of their point of view. Whether they're an atheist, agnostic, believer, it doesn't matter. We have respect for all human beings. Now, God has told us in the Quran that people are always receive a payback for whatever good they do. So people who don't believe in God, they could be complete atheists, wonderful people, kind, merciful people, great people. They're going to receive their benefit here on this earth. But they can't expect a benefit in the hereafter because they didn't believe in the hereafter. So whatever good they did, they're going to get all their points here on earth. Great. But we as Muslims should never, it's disallowed to hate anybody, dislike anybody based on the religious point of view, their personalities, any of those kind of issues.
I'd be very interested to hear about your personal journey from your early Catholic days to becoming a Muslim. We've shared Sure. a lot of personal stories here in this church
Sure.
with great variation.
How many people in this room were raised as Catholic? So maybe 50%. As I go out, it doesn't matter what church I go to. It could be a UU, it could be a Lutheran church, it could be a lot of different things. I ask, half of the people in there were raised as Catholics. So those who are raised as Catholics know what the issues are. Those who aren't know another set of issues. I think as I was raised as a Catholic, I inherently I had a problem with the concept of church law. That there was some human being who could make a law that could say, if you do this, you're going to go to hell. If you eat meat on Friday, you're going to go to hell. Now we change the law 20 years later. The guy doesn't eat meat on eats meat on Friday. He doesn't go to hell. So this whole concept that a church and human beings can make laws which affect us in the afterlife. So I thought there was a problem here. Then I also had, I really didn't believe in the divinity of Jesus. I thought Jesus was maybe just a myth. I never thought Jesus was a real person because I couldn't understand all the things I was taught about the nature of Jesus. So I became an agnostic, or if not an agnostic, someone who didn't have a strong trust of formal religion. And it wasn't until I was 39, I had a very close friend who was a Jew. His father was a rabbi. And he was Mexican, so Mexican Jew, his father's a rabbi. He invited me one night to go to a mosque in New York City and meet some Muslims because he himself became Muslim. And I told him, I said, you know, this sounds like the most boring way to spend a great night in New York City. I want to do a lot of things. Going to a mosque doesn't sound too cool. But I went because a friend asked me. And when I went to this mosque, the thing that interested me was not what people were saying, but how people were treating one another. People were serving one another. The men were in the kitchen cleaning, helping things. You know, people were very helpful and very concerned that I, as a guest, would be well taken care of. No one spoke about religion. Not one word was spoken.
But I was so impressed with the character of the people, the good quality of the people, that I started studying about Islam. And every single thing I studied about in terms of the concept, the basic beliefs of Islam, I believed. It made sense to me. One night when I was in New York City, the imam there, the preacher there said, I think you should become a Muslim today. And at that time, I was the executive director of the Milwaukee Art Museum, very well-known personality in Milwaukee. Grew up in this very traditional Roman Catholic family background. I did everything that a typical American Milwaukee man would do. And I thought about this for about 30 seconds. And first of all, I thought, well, Muslims don't drink. How is this going to work? You know, since 16 years old, you have a cocktail every night. Then I thought, I gamble every Wednesday night with the boys. We have card games. How is this going to work? And I thought about a couple other things. I thought, well, if this is the right thing to do, God makes it easy. Don't be afraid. Just jump in. So I did. I went back. I made this decision to be Muslim. I went back to Milwaukee, told my family, who had not met this nice group of people in New York City. This is 21 years ago. And my mother looked at me and burst into tears. She said, you can't be Muslim. And I said, why not? She said, you're white. She had never seen any picture of a white Muslim. She thought this is the only thing for people of color. And I went back to the art museum, my employees, most of who are very highly educated women, and they knew I was a nice boss, believed in family practices and all these good things. And they thought, uh-oh, you're Muslim. We've read about these Muslim guys. This is going to be a disaster. And everybody had a problem with it. The president of the art museum board of directors was a confirmed Zionist, loved Israel. And I told him, and he asked me, what is this going to do for the museum? I mean, what impact is this going to have? Many of our donors are Jews. Is this going to be an issue? And I said, no. I said, the only problem may be, I says, I won't go to occupied Palestine. The Jewish community in Milwaukee puts together all these trips going to what I consider occupied Palestine. I'm not comfortable doing that. So please, when you organize these, don't invite me to go there because I can't do that. It's going to hurt my feelings to see people abused. And he started crying. And I said, I'm sorry. Why are you so upset? He said, well, my own brother feels that way. He won't go there either. His brother is a Jew. So everybody had a different point of view. None of them good. There was a huge article in the Milwaukee Journal about this. I had calls to my family, my parents, everyone. It was like sympathy calls. It was like, your son is a traitor. Your son broke the basic rules of society. What a horrible thing. It was really a disaster for them because everyone came out of the woodworks thinking that this was like the most despicable, disgraceful thing I could have done. And I noticed people looked at me differently at work and were out and about. But after a while, people kind of get into a normative stance. And my mother, before she died, she brought my brothers and sisters together, and she said, you know, I raised my son as a Roman Catholic. He left home at 17. He called me once every 6 months, usually for money. He never paid any attention to you, brothers and sisters. Now he's a Muslim. He's here every week. He supports most of the family. He takes care of us. He calls. He's solicitous. I've decided that Islam is the only true religion because it affected his behavior. Now, people only care how we treat them. At the end of the day, who cares what you believe? It doesn't matter. It's how you treat people. Well, she decided she liked Islam because it changed my behavior. My behavior conformed with traditional Islamic teaching, take care of your parents, take care of your brothers and sisters and family. So she thought Islam was terrific. She told all my brothers and sisters they should become Muslim before she died. So this is kind of the continuum between, the biggest crises in the world to somebody who was very happy with it. So.
Please feel welcome to join Issa for a coffee conversation after the service. Our closing words are from 19th century Unitarian minister Theodore Parker. Be ours a religion which, like sunshine, goes everywhere, its temple all space, its shrine the good heart, its creed all truth, its ritual works of love, its profession of faith, divine living.